This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Utterly Moderate is the official podcast of the Connors Institute for Nonpartisan Research and Civic Engagement at Shippensburg University. Please visit us at connorsinstitute.org to sign up for our free email newsletter. While you are there, also be sure to check out all of our great research and resources.
Please listen carefully. Carefully.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the program. This is the Utterly Moderate Podcast, and I'm your host, Lawrence Eppard. Thank you so much for joining us. On today's show, we're going to be talking to Lisa Sellen Davis. Lisa is a writer who's written on a number of topics, including transgender-related issues. And we're going to be talking about a recent incident in academia that sheds light not just on research into transgender issues, but also broader problems that are plaguing academia today. Now, a part of our discussion focuses on the peer review process, and there are probably plenty of our listeners out there who are perfectly familiar with this process, so forgive me for summarizing it here, and if you need to, you can just sort of fast forward through this little bit of the show, but let me give you a really quick, lightning-fast, Cliff Notes version of what the peer review process is in academic research. All right, so say I'm a researcher, and I've just finished a research study and written it up into an academic article. In the article, I summarize the previous research that's been done on this topic, state my hypothesis, go into great detail about the methods that I use to test that hypothesis, report and discuss my findings, detail the conclusions that can be drawn from my findings, state the limitations of my research, and then list the sources that I cited in my paper. All right, so I've done all those things, written it up. I email my article off to the editor of an academic journal. At that point, the editor could decide to reject the article. Maybe it's not a good fit for the specialty area that that journal publishes, or maybe I didn't even meet basic standards of academic rigor. But if it does those things, if it's a good fit for that journal and it meets basic standards, they will send a blinded copy off to two or three experts on that particular topic. And blinded just means they remove my name and any other information from the article that could suggest who wrote it. In this process, I don't know who the reviewers are, so I can't influence the process, I can't retaliate against them, and they don't know who I am, so they'll judge my work just on the merits and not on what they think about me. All right, so once these reviewers have my article, they go through it, they try to poke holes in it, they try to rip it apart, discredit it. They want to make sure that it stands up to the harshest of critiques. Is the methodology sound? Do the findings truly support the hypothesis? Are the conclusions that the author draws really appropriate considering the findings? All right, so they do all that, again, just kind of ripping it to pieces, cross-examining it like it's a hostile witness. Then they write up their critiques in a really detailed report and send them back to the editor. In that report, they'll give a recommendation to do one of three things with the article. Either publish it as it is, reject it, or publish the article on the condition that I make certain changes suggested by the reviewer. All right, so the editor has the reviews. They evaluate them, see what the general consensus is among these experts, and send the journal's decision back to the article's author along with the peer reviewer's reports. Now, at really prestigious journals, the vast majority of articles are rejected, more than 90% in some cases. And the ones that are eventually published have usually been revised in some way or gone through several rounds of revisions according to the suggestions of the reviewers. And from the time that a researcher first submits their article to a journal to the time it's finally published, oftentimes it can be a year or more that has passed. Once the article is published, of course, it becomes part of the scholarly conversation. Other scholars see it, they critique it, they build upon it, and the science moves forward. It's really a pretty magical process, and it works really great in the natural sciences. In the social sciences, however, we're having some problems. So this process works best when not everybody in it has the same biases, the same blind spots, the same interests. But if I'm biased and my research is flawed because of it, people who have the same exact biases as me will probably also fail to see how flawed that research is because they see the world in the same way as me. And this is what's been happening in the social sciences. We've become so homogeneous that a lot of flawed research makes it into print because the reviewers often have the same exact blind spots as the researchers producing the flawed research. Now, academia, of course, has always had a leftward tilt, but it's gotten much, much more imbalanced in recent decades. In my field of sociology, it's 40-1, liberals to conservatives. Psychology, it's 17-1, and so on. Now, I've brought Lisa Sellin Davis on the show today to talk about a recent incident in academia that I think really highlights a lot of these problems. So let's just cut to it and bring her in to get the conversation started. Lisa Sellin Davis, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so today I want to talk about this article that Sally Baxendale published in Unheard, talking about a review study that she did on, I believe it was puberty blockers and cognitive function. And it really wasn't even a study. It was just a review of the studies. And what was troubling to me was not that her paper initially got rejected by three journals. Papers get rejected all the time. What was troubling to me was the way she described her interactions with the reviewers, and or at least what the reviewers said in their reviews. So, but let's start with... So a number of European countries, including, let's see, Norway, Finland, Sweden, the UK, are taking, compared to the past, a more cautious approach when it comes to gender-affirming care. And so when it comes to the use of puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, transition-related surgeries, they're taking a more cautious approach. And so tell me why, first of all, is that true? Am I right that European countries are kind of taking a different track than the US? And if so, why are they doing that?
First of all, not every European country is doing that. But some are, the ones you mentioned. And I think we should differentiate between suggesting a more cautious approach and taking a more cautious approach. Because I would say some of them have put out guidelines, but it doesn't mean that all the practitioners are doing things according to the guidelines. But yes, they're suggesting a very cautious approach for, I would say, three reasons mainly. One is the rate of detransition was higher than they thought. They told several people told me they didn't think it was super high, but definitely higher than the 1% that was often touted. But no one knows for sure. Number two, they realized that the people seeking these interventions were very different than the cohort studied. So the cohort studied had lifelong gender dysphoria and lived in supported families. And they were just a very, very particular bunch. And they also had they were very high functioning before they transitioned. And they continue to be high functioning after. But there's no way to tell if the therapy or the transition is what made it a success or just the fact that they were already high functioning. And the people coming in for treatment tended to have serious mental health problems, did not have lifelong gender dysphoria. It was just a very, very different cohort. And finally, they looked at the evidence for the effects of puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and they found it to be of very low quality. And that means that it's almost impossible to tell if the outcome described in a study will be the actual outcome for anyone who partakes of it.
Right. So there seem to be some really valid concerns in these countries over the use of puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and transition-related surgeries in children. So some of those concerns center around health, whether these things together or by themselves can hurt people's hearts, their bone development, their cognitive development, their sexual function, and their fertility. Other concerns are about the issue of whether a child can truly give consent, whether they can truly understand the risks they're taking on, whether they can truly understand the kinds of life-altering decisions they're making about breast removal or penis removal. And so based upon a lot of these concerns, European countries are changing how they're thinking about this. And this is in Forbes from Josh Cohen. He says, quote, "In essence, progressively the message emanating from European gender experts is that until there is reliable long-term evidence that the benefits of youth gender transition outweigh the risks, it is prudent to limit most medical interventions to rigorous clinical research settings," end quote. And so there's been some data collected and analyzed by public health authorities in Finland, Sweden, the Netherlands, England. And what they've argued is, what they found in these reviews is that the risk-benefit ratio of youth gender transition ranges from unknown to unfavorable. I mean, is that your understanding?
I think it's all just unknown. I mean, maybe it's totally fine. You know, I am always, I'm willing to go with what the evidence says, but right now these are all question marks. There isn't anything definitive and there are concerns. And I've never seen a field of medicine in which all concerns are dismissed as hateful, dangerous. Maybe you're right, but if we admit it, it'll make things harder for people. So going on to Sally's piece, you know, she did this essentially a literature review. It's not even a systematic review to say, basically, we don't know, you know, and that's so different from the declarative, this is safe and fully reversible. And so the peer reviewers didn't argue with her conclusions or, you know, we need more research, et cetera. They had all kind of ideological reasons. So they asked her to look for, I wrote this down, they asked her to look for, because they couldn't find any peer-reviewed studies that said this is safe and reversible, they asked her to look through non-peer-reviewed presentations to look for unpublished studies that might be more positive. They said if they published it, it could stigmatize an already stigmatized group. I mean, science doesn't care about that, right? And it asked her to focus. They asked her to focus on the positive things that puberty blockers do, or that you shouldn't publish a review when there's not a lot of literature to review. Now, that seems really important. You know, there's not a lot of literature to review. Maybe
that
someone
was the one that was the, that was one of the responses she detailed that bothered me the most.
Yeah,
because that's a huge finding, right? Like, if you're really concerned about the long term impacts of a medical intervention, and you find that there's no research that documents the long term impacts of that medical intervention, seems like an important finding.
My concern is that kids and their families aren't properly informed about what we know and don't know. So anyone saying we know that these medications are totally fine is essentially lying. And to have a literature review rejected because they don't like the findings, as opposed to there's something wrong with the methodology, et cetera, is also really concerning. Who would want to find out later that the thing that you were told was evidence-based and life-saving wasn't? It is not fair to anyone seeking these treatments. And I think a more accurate way of putting it would be, we have no good evidence to say whether this will help you or hurt you. Some people feel like it saved their lives, and some people feel like it ruined their lives. And there is no test we can take. We don't even know how to measure success or failure.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think, my impression in a number of pieces, including places that you don't expect from the New York Times and a variety of others, my impression when they talk to a lot of these folks is that they're not actually getting that, right? So if you were told, look, this is experimental, the Europeans have said this is experimental. If you're told that, and we're not sure how it's going to go, we hope that it relieves your pain. That would be one thing, right? But I don't think that's what's happening. But I also don't have an idea on what the normal experience is for kids, right? Like, are the examples we're hearing about just the worst ones that ran to the New York Times?
Wouldn't it be great to know what was actually happening? That's my take. My take is, let's get the data. So, even before regulating, get the data, right? So I would like there to be an inquiry into gender clinics as well as informed consent clinics, you know, Planned Parenthood, et cetera. I mean, I think you don't need a clinic anyway. You can, a lot of things you can get from your primary care doctor. You can go to a specialist. You're not necessarily going through these programs at gender clinics. So yeah, I would want to collect all the data and then decide what to do.
So let me just quote a couple of things from this article. So she says, again, it's not the issue that paper was rejected. It was the responses from the reviewers. She says, I've never encountered the kinds of concerns that some of the reviewers expressed in response to my review of puberty blockers. In this case, it wasn't the methods they object to. It was the actual findings. And so you mentioned some of them. She says none of the reviewers, by the way, said she was wrong. They didn't identify any long-term studies that were contrary to her findings. You mentioned the one that said you should trawl through unpublished research. I've never, I'm an academic. I'm not aware of that being something that you're supposed to do. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I saw the one you said about, stigmatizing. We talked about not enough literature to review, which is a major finding. But another one that caught my eye was, and this one just baffled me. They said this reviewer sought to diminish an entire field of neuroscience that has established puberty as a critical period of brain development by saying this was just Sally's view. I mean, I'm not a neuroscientist, and I'm well aware of that.
Yeah. What we are seeing is things that are well known being declared opinion and things that are completely unknown being declared fact. And I feel bad for children and families navigating a system like that. There's a whole narrative that is in the way of just being able to have an honest discussion about the science. And what Sally encountered was the narrative matters more than any science at all.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Yes, one more of the responses that aligns with what we're talking about. She says, the most astonishing response she received from a reviewer was that she, Sally, was approaching the topic from a bias of heavy caution. And this reviewer appeared to be advocating for a default position of assuming medical treatments are safe until proven otherwise. Just really, really troubling. I mean, I thought, and again, I'm I'm not trans. I'm not an expert at any of this. But I thought in reading some of these European countries and their approach, you know, pausing until the, and not pausing therapy, not pausing, you know, a whole host of things, like you said, support, but pausing life-altering changes until after puberty had concluded seemed reasonable to me. But okay, so this is a hugely complex conversation. We have barely touched the surface. We were really talking about what seems like a really inappropriate review from some of these reviewers on Baxen Dale's article. But I would say one thing, my impression as a sociologist in a field that's 40-1 liberal to conservative, you know, psychology 17-1, my impression is that the peer review process and the just the scientific enterprise as a whole in some of these disciplines, I'm not talking about chemistry, I'm not, you know, and but in some fields they have been derailed and captured by ideology in ways that are really damaging the effectiveness of the process, the value of the research. Is that your impression, or am I overstating this?
My impression is that the peer review process is very broken, not just because of the ratio of liberals to conservatives, but because I don't think we have liberals. I think we have fundamentalists who on the left, who again would prefer anything that pushes their own narrative forward. And I suspect that when you're pushing something that you know on some level is really flawed, that's what makes you so defensive. This is a bigger psychology question, but that's what I think is part of the ferociousness with trying to censor people, is that they know they have good arguments, or they know that the evidence is weak. So they just, and they know that they've been telling half-truths or downright untruths. And that accounts, yeah, for why they try to silence people. I think it contributes to the lack of faith more and more people have in our institutions, in our universities, in these disciplines. And for many of us, the more we learn, the harder it is to have any conversation about this, because it's so different from what other people around us think and believe and what they read in the New York Times. I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but you start to believe, wow, every institution is captured. And it's hard for me to know what publication I can trust in the media. I have to try to figure out what individual reporters, what individual scientists I can trust. It's a lot of work. Each person sort of has to be their own fact checker. And I think that's the problem. Where are the grown-ups? Where are the old school people who will say the truth matters no matter what, no matter how inconvenient it is? I hope they're coming out of the woodwork this year. That's my dream.
Well, I mean, it makes me paranoid, because I feel like there's a part of the story that is being hidden or distorted. And so that makes you paranoid, because like you said, then you don't know who to trust. And then when I find somebody who I think is uncovering some of the stuff, I'm equally paranoid, because I'm like, well, is this person just a delusional anti-trans person? And yeah, they're only showing me the bad. It is really difficult. And the one thing that makes me feel like I'm on course and I'm actually trying to objectively look at this is the concern of those European countries.
Yeah.
Right.
That
like,
helps.
If this kind of US polarized conversation was happening everywhere, which I'm sure it is in many countries, that'd be one thing. but it seems like these are genuine concerns of some major organizations and major wealthy countries.
One hopes so. One hopes that the concern is not rooted in some kind of bias or bigotry. And again, the best thing that we could do is just get as much real data as possible. Something that could cut through this culture of censorship. And I'm not saying banning, I'm saying getting the whole story. More than we have, I guess.
Lisa Sellen Davis, I always enjoy talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us. The article that we've been discussing is Why Did Three Journals Reject My Puberty Blocker Study? Trans Children Deserve to Know the Facts. It was written by Sally Baxendale, who's a clinical neuropsychologist at the University College of London. It was published by Unheard on February 12th, 2024, and we've linked to the article in the show description. The academic article in question that Sally writes about was about the state of the research on whether puberty blockers are harmful to people's cognitive functioning, and she argues that the responses she got from peer reviewers suggests that ideology is clouding the judgment of the experts responsible for making sure that the best science is available to trans children and their families. Thanks for joining us again for this very difficult conversation. Take care, and we'll see you next time.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails. About the clouds when we're together, just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again. Trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you. Goodbye, good luck, and may the good Lord take a liking to you.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.